From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. And next hour, the Trillion Dollar Conspiracy with Jim Mars. Get ready for that. But here's what's happening. You know, here's one of those stories that will make you just shake your head. We know how bad it is when little babies are left in hot cars, right? Well, listen to this bizarre story. In St. Charles, Missouri, police say that 25 adult cats and two medium-sized dogs were found trapped in a hot car at the Ameristar Casino parking garage. Can you imagine that? 25 adult cats and two medium-sized dogs. Someone called 911 after spotting the animals suffering inside of this green Chevy Lumina on the garage's fourth level. Police responded. They found the dogs and cats somewhere inside cages, some out inside of the Lumina. The animals were left without water, but with some food scattered on the car's floor. The car's windows were cracked open about an inch. The outside temperature at the time was about 90 degrees, and casino security told police that the temperatures inside the garage typically runs about 7 to 8 degrees hotter than the outside, so maybe about 100 degrees in the car. Police say the owner of the car, 39-year-old Lori Pellin, was found at the casino's hotel's computer room. She told detectives that she had the animals because she was homeless and living in her car after having been evicted from her apartment about 3 days ago. Pellin told police that she had done some gambling and then used the hotel's computer to search for an apartment. Pellin was charged with two counts of misdemeanor animal abuse and may face more charges depending on the conditions of the animals. Bizarre. The Supreme Court rules that Americans have the right to own a gun for self-defense anywhere they live. By a very close 5-4 vote, the justices cast doubt on handgun bans in the Chicago area, but signaled that some limitations on the Constitution's right to keep and bear arms could survive some legal challenges. In a moment, Professor John Lott joins us, author of More Guns, Less Crimes, and Bias Against Guns. The Federal Trade Commission has disrupted a long-running online scam that allowed offshore fraudsters to steal millions of dollars from you, often taking just pennies at a time. The scam, which had been run for about 4 years, according to the FTC, provides a case lesson in how many of the online services used to lubricate business in the 21st century can equally be misused for fraud. The scammer stayed under the radar by charging very small amounts, typically between 25 cents to $9 a card, and setting up more than 100 bogus companies to process these transactions. Catherine Albrecht is a consumer privacy expert and founder of the Casbian Organization, which educates consumers about shopper surveillance. Catherine, in this particular case, now, how did they find these people?
Well, that's the one piece that's still kind of a mystery, because they came up with literally 1.35 million credit card numbers. Now, these are credit card numbers that possibly even your listeners may have been the victims of this scam and may not even have noticed. The charges ranged between 25 cents to just $9 a charge. And so what would happen is people would get their statements. There'd be a company on there with a name that you'd kind of go, I'm not sure what that is, a name like Lex Bay or Adele Services.
Oh, geez.
People would see these little charges. They'd be, yeah, 50 cents, 75 cents. And amazingly, they were able to get away with this and scam $9.5 million out of these people, essentially because 94% of people who got these charges on their bills never contested them.
The fact that they found them, does that mean these charges are going to stop?
Well, they would have to start over from scratch. What they had done is they managed to put together over 100 fake businesses in the United States. Now, these were scammers based over in Bulgaria, Estonia, over in the former Eastern Bloc. And they were able to set up very, very sophisticated business practices to make it look like they were in the U.S. Now, here's the other kick if people want to be on the lookout for these guys. They had employed what they call money mules. These are Americans who set up bank accounts for these people and help them ship the money offshore. Now, those people have all been arrested by the FTC, but it turns out after they arrested them that they essentially were patsies. They didn't even know they were taking part in a scam. You know those emails you get that say, hey, help me get some money offshore?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's what they did. They sent out spam emails to people, and they got 14 of them to sign up and help them.
Oh, gosh.
Into other countries.
Another scam. Catherine, thanks. Catherine's website, she's got many, will be part of our Twitter feed, coasttocoastam.com. In a step toward curing diabetes in humans, scientists at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis have alleviated this disease in rats using transplants from both embryonic and adult pigs. The rats adopted the pig transplants as their own and produced enough insulin to control their blood sugar, all without the need for anti-rejection drugs. The researchers report their findings online in the American Journal of Pathology. A new study led by a federal drug safety expert ties the controversial diabetes drug Avendia to a higher risk of heart problems, strokes, and deaths in older people, and says it's more dangerous than a rival drug, Actos. Women in their late 30s are freezing eggs because they are still hunting for Mr. Right. According to research, a study of women at a Belgian clinic found half wanted to freeze their eggs to take the pressure off finding a partner. A third of them also said they were having their eggs frozen as an insurance policy against infertility. Facebook has removed the main Boycott BP from its page, and with it, leaving almost 800,000 fans just hanging. The group was created with the intent of sending a clear and strong message to BP and to Washington that what has happened to the Gulf has got to stop everywhere. People from all over the world shared video clips, pictures, and frustration over what has been the incredibly slow process to an ever-growing economic and environmental disaster. The boycotter and creator, Lee Perkins, just couldn't figure out what's going on. He set up another Facebook account, but they'll probably get to him soon enough. One of two relief wells being drilled in an attempt to stop BP's runaway oil well below the Gulf is now within 20 feet horizontally of it. The relief well has reached a depth of 16,770 feet, but engineers plan to drill another 900 feet vertically before cutting in sideways. BP has 44,000 barrels of mud ready to inject into the well in an attempt to stop the world's worst economic disaster, or at least I should say our nation's. Captain Kelly Sweeney monitors these situations. Kelly, but they say they're not going to be able to reach it until early August, so we still have time.
We sure do, George. It's ahoy to you and all the listeners, and yes, it's they're going to go down another close to 1,000 feet, and then they're going to have to go in that last 20 feet, and it's going to go very, very slowly as they approach that 7.5-inch pipe and then try to punch in there without going through or missing, and they'll probably miss a few times as they're getting close, and then inject the mud in the bottom kill to try to stop it. And also in other things, George, that I wanted to pass on regarding the cleanup, all eyes right now are on Tropical Storm Alex, which you and I talked about last week and is now here. Oil spill skimming and cleanup operations off the coast of Louisiana were suspended today at 3 o'clock Central Time. The vessel's heading into safe harbor in anticipation and because of the effects of the storm. And two large oil spill cleanup ships, one coming from Los Angeles and the other coming from San Francisco, both of them en route to the spill, are caught in the tropical storm. And I'm very concerned about the mariners because these vessels are not well suited to ride out a hurricane. And I'm also concerned, George, in our vulnerability because now there are no large oil spill cleanup ships for the entire Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast all the way up to the Oregon-Washington border should the need arise.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, thanks, Kelly. Mexican singer Sergio Vega has been shot dead only hours after he denied reports that he had been murdered. Listen to this. The 40-year-old singer known as El Chaca told a website that he had increased security measures after a number of Mexican musicians were killed and that he was very alive. Musicians performing what they called the narco corridos, songs celebrating the lives of drug barons, often become the targets of rival drug gangs. Well, somebody or a group killed him a short time after that. Scientists working on the Large Hadron Collider say they have moved a step closer to their aim of unlocking the mysteries of the universe The collider is now generating about 10,000 particle collisions per second. The Large Hadron Collider is housed in a circular tunnel under the French-Swiss border. Apple, they're going crazy. They've sold more than 1.7 million units of its new iPhone model in the first 3 days. The iPhone 4 went on sale on Thursday in the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, and Japan. High demand for the model caused shortages and unruly crowds at some of the stores. And doctors treating a man who had a lucky escape after a fence post speared him through the chest found a four-leaf clover stuck to his back. The 20-year-old, Raymond Curry, was on his way to work when his car overturned and rolled through a fence near his home. He was flown to a hospital, still impaled by the piece of wood, which had amazingly missed all of his vital organs. But after they were able to help him, they noticed the lucky four-leaf clover on his back. You talk about luck. Up next, the Supreme Court and its ruling. John Lott, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. As I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court has ruled that Americans have the right to own a gun for self-defense anywhere they live. By a close 5-4 vote, the justices cast doubt on handgun bans in the Chicago area. John Lott, senior research scientist at the University of Maryland, has written books on guns, More Guns, Less Crime, The Bias Against Guns. Here he is on Coast to Coast. John, this was a close vote, though, 5-4. If this comes up before the court again and they've switched justices, it could go the other way, can it?
Oh, sure. There's a lot at stake. It's a very close vote. You read the dissenting opinions for the four justices who are opposed, and they see no individual right for people owning guns. They see no problem with governments completely banning all gun ownership. So it's, this is a pretty easy question. I mean, we're not talking about complicated gun regulations here. We're just saying, can a government completely ban people owning guns? And the Supreme Court said, if the Second Amendment means anything, if there's any notion to there being an individual right, then it can't completely ban guns. It's leaving open for later court cases what regulations can be imposed. It hasn't touched on that. Basically, courts have this rule that they only deal with the question directly in front of them, and that was the only question in front of them this time.
John, let me ask you the hypothetical question, though. If this comes up before a different Supreme Court,
sure,
the makeup changes,
right,
and they vote the other way,
right,
not the way that this court did, does that mean that all cities would have the right to simply ban guns?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. What a way to get them off the streets then, right? And out of the hands of Americans.
Right.
They would literally slap the Second Amendment, wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, and it's a very close vote. It's 5-4, as you say. And if Justice Kennedy or one of the four more conservative justices were to die and get replaced, as Obama's been replacing them, people with Sonia Sotomayor or Elena Kagan, you could have a real change, a massive change there.
Is there anything Americans would be able to do legally if the Supreme Court made that kind of a ruling?
Well, the only thing they could change is they could change the Senate and the president and try to get justices in there that would change it back again. But that's a long time.
Oh, my gosh.
Process.
John, what about guns that people already legally own? We have permits. What would they do under that scenario?
Well, you know, if the justices who are in the minority today were in the majority, they essentially would allow any government regulations, which means that they would allow governments to go and take guns from people that already had them.
Man, I'd like to say, nah, that's not going to happen, but it could.
Well, I mean, those types of things have happened in the sense that when Washington, D.C. Passed its gun ban, if you had a handgun prior to the ban, you had to get rid of it. You weren't allowed to keep owning it once they passed the ban. The four justices, the four liberal justices, thought that that regulation was perfectly fine.
Where do we stand opinion-wise, John, about ownership of guns? Is it close, about 50-50, people like them, people don't? Where do we stand with that?
Well, the
surveys that I've seen indicate that a huge majority of Americans believe that there is an individual right to own a gun. That's one reason why when Sonia Sotomayor was up for confirmation last year, she said that she believed in individual right to own guns. Of course, now that she's on the court and the opinion came out today, she signed on with Justice Breyer, who said that there was not an individual right. Or back in the 2008 campaign, President Obama basically disowned the past stands that he had taken as a state legislator and as a senator on guns and said that he believed in individual right to own guns. Of course, then he appoints Supreme Court justices who strongly don't believe in individual right to self-defense.
So if people were out celebrating, not with their guns in their hands, right, over this decision today, would you tell them, hey, folks, don't celebrate too much because it could go the other way one day?
Right. It's an important decision. It's one of what will have to be many. You know, just like you look at the abortion battles over time, you know, after you had Roe v. Wade, you know, whatever your stand on it, it's, you have to recognize that then you had partial birth abortions and you had parental notification and you had different types of state health and safety regulations that came up, and all those were contested decisions. And the thing you have to realize is that courts are bound only to look at the issues that are brought before them. And so here we just have a complete ban. Somebody else, the next cases may involve the new rules in Chicago and Washington, D.C. After the handgun ban was struck down in Washington, D.C., in order to get a handgun, you have to pay a $550 fee. You have to go to the police station four times. You have to take a training class. You have to take two written tests. And there are other regulations. And Chicago is saying that they're going to pass those plus additional ones. And those types of regulations are going to have to go before the court. And they're going to eventually decide whether that represents an infringement. I mean, I think it does. The court, for example, if Chicago tried to put a tax on just newspapers, the court would strike it down even if it was a penny tax, because they would say that would violate the freedom of the press. But I would think they would say a $550 fee is too much. Also, in the case of guns, who gets hurt the most by something like these huge fees and the training costs and other things that are there? It's the only people who are going to be able to get guns are going to be the wealthiest individuals. If my research in more guns, less crime convinces me of anything, it's poor people, particularly poor blacks who live in high crime urban areas, who are most likely to be victims of crime, who benefit the most from having the option to be able to have a gun to protect themselves.
Exactly. Law-abiding citizens, what does your gut tell you? If law-abiding citizens have their guns taken away, what becomes of the crime in this country?
But it goes up, and we've seen that time after time. I hope Americans know what happened in both D.C. and Chicago when they had bans. Crime went up, and it went up dramatically afterwards. D.C., if you look at the top 50 cities in population, D.C. ranked usually between 20th and 15th in terms of murder rates prior to their ban. In the 28 years that the ban was in effect, they ranked in the number one half the time and in the top four two-thirds of the time. They never were that high prior to the ban. And as soon as the ban ends, murder rates decline.
They go
down. It's gone down by about 40% now if you look at the data, including this year, since the ban ended. And violent crime has gone down across the board. Now I think part of that is due to the gun laws. You know, people concentrate a lot on the handgun ban, but because they've made it so difficult for many people to buy guns, you only have handguns. You only have about 900 to 1,000 people with permits now for handguns. But you have 70,000 people in Washington, D.C. who have a registered long gun. And the thing is, prior to the Heller decision, it was a crime to have a loaded, unlocked long gun, even if you were facing a criminal, even if you'd only just loaded it, unlocked it, because a criminal was threatening your life. it was still a felony for you to do that. And the Supreme Court said, look, if there's an individual right to have a gun, you also have to have an individual right for self-defense to use it. And gun lock laws, like we had in Washington, D.C., made it impossible for people to use a gun for self-defense. And so they struck that down.
Man, it's just an incredible story, John Lott. Will you stay with us? We're going to come back with you in just a moment. And we're going to open up the phone lines with our special guest this hour, John Lott, reacting to what the Supreme Court did, and that was ruling that you have the right to own a gun for self-defense so far. Next hour, our special guest Jim Marrs joins us, the trillion-dollar conspiracy. Jim just landed in Texas, bouncing through storms, but he'll be ready in just a moment. And when we come right back, we'll take your phone calls with John Lott as we talk about the Supreme Court ruling today about your right to own a gun for self-defense. Okay, welcome back. We've got John Lott. We're going to take your phone calls. John, are there any more gun cases hanging around the court systems right now that you know of?
Well, there are several. I suppose the biggest ones deal with the regulations that have come up in Washington, D.C. after the Heller case. So the registration, the high fees that you have to pay to go and get it, and all the tests. Essentially, it's asking, are these essentially banned light? That has occurred there. But it's going to be a quite different case than the simple question of whether a complete ban is constitutional or not, because when you get into these other things like registration, there are going to be safety trade-offs that the courts are going to take into account, I think, much more. I think it's an easy question to go and deal with. The big problem with something like registration is, in theory, if a criminal leaves a gun at a crime scene and you trace it back to the criminal who it's registered to, then you can arrest them. The problem is, one, crime guns are virtually never left at the crime scene. Two, if they're left, it's because the criminal's been killed or injured. And three, even if they are left, they're never registered to the guy who committed the crime, even if they are registered to somebody. And so you look at whether it's Chicago, which has had registration, or Washington, D.C., or Hawaii, I can't find any crimes in those cities that have been solved as a result of registration, despite what you may see on Law and Order or something
right.
like that. And Canada, which has had registration since the 1930s for handguns, claims that someplace between one and three crimes have been solved as a result of registration. Hawaii, for example, police spend 50,000 hours a year dealing with the registration rules that they have. They're filing the papers, keeping track of everything. That's 50,000 hours that the police could go and be used to solve real crimes, things that we know work with regard to police. Instead, we're making them waste things where they can't even point to one crime that's been solved over 50 years. I think that with the right arguments, it should be a slam dunk case, because it's not a trade-off between freedom and safety. Here, freedom and safety, I believe, go together.
Okay, let's go to some of the calls. We'll go to Queens, New York. First-time caller, Colin, you're on Coast to Coast with John Lott. Go ahead, Colin.
Hey, George and John. Actually, I wanted to know if it applies to me. Can I just go out and buy a gun in New York, being that it's been banned for God knows how long?
Well, I mean, New York obviously has very strict gun laws there. It's going to take time. It's still on the books there. You have to, just because Chicago's complete ban has been thrown out, the type of registration and licensing and their ability to go and deny people to be able to own a gun is something that's going to have to be specifically challenged. Somebody's going to have to be, if you live in New York and you want to try to be, you get turned down for getting a permit, you might be eligible to go and try to challenge the law. It's a long, costly, difficult process, but there'll be groups just like there were groups like the Second Amendment Foundation, which helped finance the suit in Chicago, who will bring them. But it's going to be a process that takes many years before we get an answer to how far this goes. You know, a ban is an easy thing. You know, if we'd lost on the ban, then obviously the Second Amendment would have been completely meaningless. But where we're going to be able to get the courts to draw the line is an open question. Now, I would like it if we had one like 7-2 on the Supreme Court or 8-1, because then you know, as you go to more difficult questions, you can lose one or two justices there and still have majority. As it is, you know, maybe Justice Kennedy, he's willing to say a complete ban goes too far, but who knows? Maybe he thinks that registration is okay, and then you would be in the minority then at that point.
And you know, John, this doesn't skew just conservatives, liberals. I know a lot of people on both ends of the spectrum who are supporters of guns. Lots of them.
Yeah, I mean, liberals don't own guns at the same rate that conservatives do, but you'll find surveys that indicate someplace in the high 20% range, maybe even 30% of liberals own guns. And, you know, one of the big things that determines whether or not somebody owns a gun is whether they've been a victim of crime. And surely there have been lots of people of all sorts of different stripes that have been victims of crime. But, the people all across the political spectrum that do. Unfortunately, in terms of the Supreme Court, there, being a liberal or conservative, seems to predict perfectly how you're going to vote on this issue.
Absolutely. Okay, we go to Chicago now in Illinois on the wild card line. Terry, go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing,
John,
Terry.
I have a question. I've never owned a gun ownership, and I'm interested in a Floyd card. And now the times are tough. It seems like $12 is worth killing somebody in the city of Chicago. Aside from the ban that is in Chicago, what can people like us out here in the public do to stir interest in making guns a reality for people to protect themselves in the city of Chicago or any other place in this country?
Well, I mean, I think the thing to do is to get involved in the public debate. Yeah. There's so many issues that are going to be coming up now in Chicago. Mayor Daley wants to push this $550 fee. He wants to impose additional fees even above that. God only knows what the total fee is going to be. It just seems like there are issues there of fairness. I mean, why should it be that only really wealthy people in Chicago are going to be able to afford a gun when it's the poor people who benefit the most from doing that? Mayor Daley himself personally believes in protection of guns. He has round-the-clock bodyguards. If he understands that is important for his own protection, why does he have such a problem with letting poor people who can't afford to go and hire bodyguards, who live in much more dangerous areas than he does, have the same option to be able to go and protect themselves and their families? I think it's a question of whether you talk to friends about it or you write letters to the editor. You know, become informed and help educate others about it. You know, one of the big issues that I run into, and I wrote a whole book about kind of why people have the views that they do on guns, entitled The Bias Against Guns. But, you know, we're affected in large part because of the media that's there. You know, you hear, probably have heard without even trying to recall, what seems like many hundreds or even thousands of bad stories in the media about guns. But when was the last time you listened to the national news and heard a story about a citizen using a gun to protect himself, protect somebody else? Probably never, or maybe one or two in your whole lifetime. And yet, we know these occur regularly. You know, you can find websites that collect these things. KeepAndBearArms.com has a nice collection. There are other websites that do this, but they're usually local stories that don't even get coverage outside of the newspaper that covers it. And we know from surveys that maybe about 450,000 crimes are committed each year with guns, but we also know from similar surveys that people use guns about 2 million times a year to defend themselves. That's 4 or 5 times more frequently. But the fact that people only hear about these bad things, you know, affects their judgment about the costs and benefits of guns. And so helping tell people about defensive gun uses, letting them know where they can find and read some of these stories. Even if they just read some of them, they at least have some idea that it's more than the zero they might have thought that were occurring before.
I may start doing a little crime segment, John, with a friend of mine who trains police officers nationwide. We've got a huge law enforcement audience. As a matter of fact, we have a huge prison population audience, too. Okay. But we may do that.
My research shows in More Guns, Less Crime, that I believe this strongly, the police are the single most important factor for reducing crime. But the police themselves understand when you talk to them that they know they can't be every place. They know that there's only, you know, they can't cover the country. They arrive on these crime scenes after the crime's been committed. And they understand in their own lives, in their own careers, how important having guns are. And police, when you look at surveys of street officers, are overwhelmingly supportive of citizens being able to have guns for protection themselves because they see how important it is all the time for people having guns to defend themselves.
Well, and you'll remember, John, when we were talking back during my St. Louis days years ago when Missouri was going through two different votes for concealed weapons,
right,
failed the first time, passed the second, how many police officers, rank-and-file officers, supported those issues. It was the police chiefs who did not.
No, that's right. I was invited out by to give talks to different police groups around the state. The St. Louis Police Officers Association and others invited me out there to go and talk to their officers because they were very interested and there was very strong support already in those groups for letting citizens be able to defend themselves. You know, there's research out there. David Muster at the University of Georgia has found that when states pass right to carry laws, you actually see a drop in police killings, that criminals become less likely to go and carry guns when civilians do because they know it's riskier for them. Things can escalate. They can get into trouble. And the fact that criminals generally become less interested in carrying guns not only makes civilians safer, but it also makes police safer.
Wasn't there a case where a police officer was struggling with somebody that he had stopped and some passerby came by, had a concealed weapon, and saved the police officer?
Yeah, no, there are multiple cases like that.
Let's go to some more calls. Tommy in Concord, California, west of the Rockies. Tommy, it's all you.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Hey.
Hey, John, I wanted to ask you something. Where I live in California, there are a lot of draconian gun laws that have accumulated over the last 15 years. And right now they're looking at there's a group that's emerged locally about open carry. Have you heard of these guys?
Sure, I'm familiar with them.
Well, there's actually some legislation coming up to sort of, you know, block that. What kind of advice would you give a state like this that, you know, wants to move a little closer to the mainstream of America with, you know, a right to carry and stuff like that?
Right now in California, you're allowed to openly carry an unloaded gun. You're not allowed to carry a loaded gun.
Yeah.
And the move in the state legislature there is to ban being able to openly carry even unloaded guns. And, you know, it's not really obvious to me why there's this concern. Often when you look at these gun debates, it's about, well, something might happen. Is usually the story, and you know, they don't have specific examples where there's been problems. You know, the reason why they banned open carry of loaded weapons basically goes back to the Black Panthers in California, because they used to, prior to the late 60s, you used to be able to openly carry loaded guns in California. But you know, I guess. You know, I think it's a silly law that they're trying to put through. My own belief is that concealed carry is more valuable than open carry. You know, if one wants to go and fight different battles there, and the reason is because concealed carry has a bigger impact on crime, I believe. If you're carrying a gun openly, criminals can avoid you, or if they're going to attack, you'll be the first one.
Oh, exactly, they'll sneak up behind you or something.
Right,
you know, they'll know he's got a gun. I'll sneak up on him.
But if it's concealed and there are multiple people around, it makes it very risky for the criminal to attack because they don't know who they have to go and try to take out first. And you know, it benefits people who would never even think of owning a gun, let alone carrying it. But I think you have bigger impacts on crime rates if that's what you want to try to deal with by pushing for concealed carry. Now, California has very strict regulations. I mean, they allow concealed carry, and it varies a lot by county. I think San Francisco County has like 6 people that have permits. I think you have a couple thousand now in Los Angeles County that have permits. But it's, you know, it basically varies on the basis of the sheriff and how liberal that they're willing to be. Los Angeles County has had some lawsuits that have forced them to be more lenient over time. But, you know, California, I mean, one can go and list the laws that you have there, everything from regulations on what type of handguns can be sold. They've tried to push these as so-called safety measures, but really it's just a way of trying to raise the price of handguns and making it costly for people to do it. Again, I think it's poor people who are the ones who are hurt by this, these laws, because they're the ones who are priced out of the market.
Yeah, that's true.
But California is one case where they've had registration of a segment of assault weapons that they let her use the registration process to go and confiscate those guns from people. It's an example of how registration can end up being used to take guns away from people. But they have this micro stamping now of ammunition. You know, it's like they don't even need evidence whether these things work. I think a lot of it is just rules that they think they can make it more costly for people to own guns. And that seems to be the main goal rather than whether it actually reduces crime.
You know, Florida had reciprocity with 30-plus states. Nevada was one of them, but Nevada has kicked Florida out for some reason. What happened, do you know?
I can't remember that particular case. I mean, there every once in a while you'll have a state that changes its rule. They may say the other state doesn't have enough training. That's often the reason why they do it. But generally there's been a move towards reducing training requirements. Arizona, for example, just went from requiring a permit to not requiring a permit to carry a concealed handgun. There are other states that have gradually reduced it. So, you know, my own guess is over time, you know, if it was because of concerns about the amount of training that Florida didn't have as much as some other states,
that could be
less important over time.
I'll take some final calls here. Houston, Texas, Ernest's turn. Go ahead, Ernest.
I got a problem with I think they're really trying to put out assault weapons. They did have an incident in Pasadena where this guy was defending his neighbor's property, so he shot him. And the government tried to put him away, and Texas law protected him. Because here in the state of Texas, you can defend yourself.
Do you know this case at all, John?
Well, I don't know. It seems like there are multiple issues involved here. But, you know, I guess if you're dealing with assault weapons, we've just had, maybe make a general comment about that. We've just had a real experiment. In 2004, September 2004, we had the federal assault weapons ban sunset. You can go through the Brady campaign, different gun control groups, Feinstein, Schumer, different senators who are predicting mayhem, huge increases in murder rates soaring afterwards. The opposite's happened. Prior to the assault weapons ban, the murder rate in the U.S. was 5.7 per 100,000. Last year, it had gone down to 5 per 100,000.
Now, do they say anything about that, those same people who are so vocal against it?
No, they don't. I mean,
of course not.
Look at D.C. D.C.'s murder rates we were talking about earlier. It's fallen by about 40% since the handgun ban and the gun lock requirements.
You don't hear that on the mainstream, John.
If the opposite had happened, if it had gone up by 40%, the news coverage would be deafening on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. John, we're out of time. I want to thank you. Keep in touch with us. All right, John?
Oh, no. Great talking to you.
John Lott, always. More guns, less crime, the bias against guns as well. And we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with our very special guest, Mr. Jim Mars, the trillion-dollar conspiracy. Just came in from storms, landed in Texas, so we'll give him a few moments to shake himself dry, and then we'll be back.